So the invitation at the beginning is arriving. And this time it's going to be you employing your means for arriving. Arriving where? Here. Arriving when? Now. There is an immediacy when we're present. Not a rush, not an urgency, but just a sense of immediate availability. It's immediate, it's here and now. And it's got a kind of little bit of a uplift, a little bit of a feeling of awakening, that here and now feeling. We've all known it a gazillion times, playing or when we were children or in other things. Someone that we're in love with, we kind of immediately are present. It's immediate. So arriving first into the here and now as this clarity of what is meant by arriving. And then use whatever means of arriving in the room. And then I'll pick back up about the body. You're not getting it right. You're playing, you're learning, you're exploring. What would it mean for me? Having arrived in the room, being present in the here and now, we turn attention towards the body. The body is our object of meditation. We are centering, we're gathering and collecting around body experience. The Buddha gave more different instructions for being present in the body than any of the other instructions regarding the other foundations of mindfulness, establishments of mindfulness. So we're going to work with the elements. In this meditation, first we keep arriving, being open to feeling, knowing that we're here in the body as a reference point. That's what's the level of perception is body, not our views and opinions about the body. Letting go of judging mind. Letting go of comparing mind. letting go of fixing mind, where we're going to fix the body. If we could just fix the body, when we fix the body, because we can't fix the body. That's all fixing thoughts, all something that pulls us away from the here and now, just as judging does and comparing. There is discernment, but it's not about labeling. Judging is labeling good, bad, and taking identity. Comparing is better and worse than. The Buddha said to not think of as better than, worse than, or even the same as. So he was saying, stay out of the neighborhood. And now start to notice the lower half of the body, starting with the pelvis. And notice what is hard, firm, or heavy in the pelvic area. All of those bones that constitute the bowl of the pelvis. Earth element, earth element. You may feel it, you feel through the skin, through the flesh. Easy to feel on the chair, or the bench, the cushion for most people. It's a kind of weight underside where we feel the weight. And now the upper leg bones, the femur bones, going through the skin, through the flesh, to the bones. Feeling the bones. Firm, hard, heavy. Earth element, earth element. Earth element feels like this. The knees and the lower legs and the ankles. Cartilage and bone, relatively firm, relatively hard, relatively heavy. Earth element, earth element. The bones in the ankle, the bones in the feet, the bones in the toes, relatively firm, hard, heavy. Earth element, earth element. All this lower part of the body's earth element. In Zen, it's called sitting in the bones sometimes, this feeling. If you will, please, allow the earth element that you felt in the body to just rest on Mother Earth. This is a natural relationship we call gravity, where the earth element in the body naturally wants to rest on Mother Earth. You might feel this as a release in the lower abdomen area, or less tension in the pelvic bowl, or the spine more able, the lower spine more able to respond to the breath, or just a kind of ease in that sacrum area, or the lower lumbar area. You may not feel anything at all, but still feel the truth of the earth element. start to notice the quality of this earth element when it's resting on earth. There's a kind of stillness, a groundedness. That resting means there's no efforting. You're not having to get Mother Earth to hold your earth element. It's effortless. And now I'll go to the upper body and feel the shoulder area, the whole shoulder girdle, the upper arms. Again, feeling through to what's firm, heavy, and hard. Earth element, earth element. And now the elbow and the lower arms, those two bones and that lower arm. Relatively hard, firm, heavy. The bones in the hand and wrist, so many bones. Relatively firm, hard, heavy. Earth element. And again, let the weight be underside so that you're not holding up the arms, nor are you pushing them down. They're just dropped in this natural relationship with Mother Earth. You may feel the upper spine more flexible now, or the chest more responding to the breath, and the spine then to the breath as well. Or maybe no change. You can include this whole body, all the earth element in the body, resting on Mother Earth. And notice an upsurge in the posture or the breath when all the earth element is just resting. So powerful. Stillness, groundedness. It's not a dead stillness, this earth element, but it's still. The feeling of being able to relax into the earth with the earth element. The more one does that, the more one accesses the felt sense of body. Take it as our object, the stillness, the feeling of groundedness. Start to notice that there's also another experience in the body that we call breath, which represents the wind element. And in contrast with the stillness, the wind element has all this movement. And so start to pour your attention towards this breath, this wind element, and then sustaining that attention on the breath, on the wind element. Now notice that you can rest attention on a moving object. The breath is always changing, but attention can stay steady. Why is that? Because knowing is different than the object. So it's the knowing that stays steady. And the mind can relax, soften into this movement. So what is wind but movement? You can feel the movement of breath. That is why it's the breath of life. But now our object is the movement itself. And what is movement but energy? Let the stillness and the movement both be present. The sense of groundedness can come even with this movement of energy. Grounded in the knowing, the felt sense that you felt with the earth element can be there with the moving object. See this for yourself. being present for experience, because the knowing is still. And it can rest on an object that moves, the breath. No need to comment on the breath, no need to evaluate how well you're doing the practice. This is collecting and unifying the mind. You can follow the breath in close, or be more broad. In close, you might feel the beginning of the inhale, its birth, its duration, and its cessation. You might notice a pause after the inhale's finished, maybe not. And then the beginning of the exhale, its duration, and its ending. And maybe or maybe not another pause. If the mind is steady, experience that steadiness. If it's quiet, experience the quiet. Notice if there's any feeling of contentment in the mind. If the mind wanders away, pause for a moment, realize that it has wandered. That's that first gap. Realize that you have choice to go back to the breath. And then the request is that you do come back to the breath. And this is closing that third gap. When we know, and but somehow we don't act. any feeling of the beauty of the breath. The mind getting brighter, quieter. Steadiness of attention. This necessity of aiming might drop away. You're just there with the breath and it's very stable. Now start to notice that the knowing, that you are knowing the wind element. What is the nature of this ability to know? Just for a minute, recognize that not only is there knowing present, that you're knowing the wind element, you know that you're knowing the wind element. So this level of knowing that we know takes it to a wider dimension. Still have the wind element as our base with other earth element experience in the background. this knowing that we know is so empowering. It brings with it so many blessings. One of the tools that I hope that many of you will leave here today with, well, the whole weekend, is this ability to rest in knowing, just as you could rest in the earth, rest the earth element on earth, just as you could rest attention on the movement of the breath, the wind element. So back here, this something's being known, and you know you're knowing it, and you know that you know you're knowing it. Everything can rest back there. Everything. And it's characterized by a lot of equanimity and a sense of related to the objects of our experience, but not in a sticky way. Because that level of knowing is not clinging in nature. It doesn't move towards the object. It's simply being utilized. We call it awareness. You may like that word, not like that word. You can call it the most subtle form or empty form of consciousness, where the consciousness is more the phenomena of the capacity of consciousness and not it's not involved in consciousness of objects. It itself doesn't move. It's utilized to know, like, you know, if your nose is itching, you know, if you're sleepy, you know, if you're hungry. So you know that. But that consciousness is just like almost instinctive. It's sense-based consciousness. And this kind of what I'm pointing to here is this level of awareness. I was just with the Venerable Sumedho in a retreat in Thailand just a few weeks ago, and it was an invitation-only retreat, so he invited students for whatever reason. There were 100 of us, and he came in the first morning, and he said, I'm going to teach you what I've learned in 56 years of being a monk. And the message for 10 days was, you are awareness. Anything that arises in the mind is samkara. It's composed. It's made up. It may be skillful or unskillful. You're none of that. Let loose of all of it. But you are this impersonal awareness. And I don't mean sense consciousness, he would say. Over and over again, 10 days, awareness, 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 awareness. And that meaning, where is there a place that we can rest? This is a place we can rest. We can know our life from this level of our experience, from this access, aspect of our experience, that we can be, we can, I call it the participant observer, that we can open to the nature of this realm. But we have space around our experience. And when we look at the Four Noble Truths from this perspective, it becomes very interesting. And thus the more subtle aspects of the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth is that there is dukkha. Dukkha has many, many meanings. We translate it as suffering, but unsatisfactory is another word. Not reliable is another word. That and there's three kinds of dukkha. There's the physical and emotional discomfort, pain. We all know physical pain. Nobody has any confusion about that. That's like, yes, this doesn't feel good. This is not satisfying. There's the same with emotional pain. Then the second kind of dukkha is the kind that arises because everything's changing. So if something's always breaking in your house, have you noticed? That there's always something, after a certain age, for sure, there's always something about the body. But even the simplest thing, you've washed the dishes, and you've gone to the trouble of washing the dishes and put them away, and then you realize, but I'm just going to get them out and do it all over again. All those pans are going to get dirty all over again. That's dukkha. Oh, I've brushed my teeth and flossed and everything. I'm finished now with my teeth. Oh, no, I got to do it again the next day or twice a day, whatever your pattern is. And it goes on and on. That the endless repetition, the endless change, that nothing stays the same. And so, therefore, there's no, this is inherent dukkha of this realm. It's not like somebody's doing something wrong. It's the inherent nature of this realm. Old age, sickness, and death is because of anicca. And so a lot of the physical and emotional pain is because of anicca. People we love die. They get sick. We got to take care of them. We're worried about them. It's heartbreaking to watch them hurt so much. That's all coming because everything changes. It's the nature of things. And then the third kind of dukkha is the dukkha that arises because there's not a there in a way. We can't, if we look closely, well, where am I in this? Who is actually having this experience? What is this unmovable thing that I can say, this for sure is me? And we tend to think of it as our personality or our body or our mental activity or our private thoughts that we have inside that nobody else has, which is true, our private self. But all of those are always changing. And so we can't find up an unchanging peace like that. He would say, the Venerable Sumedho would say, but this awareness is not changing. We'll get more into that later. So, in regards to the truth that stuff happens in life, that we have disappointment, that we have loss, that we don't get what we want, that we lose what we wanted, that we have it and now we no longer want it, but we're stuck with it. All of these kinds of experiences, which are all very human, all very natural part of this realm, this is to be known. And as an insight practice, the first insight is this is an intellectual presentation. Is this not your experience of this realm? It's just asking about it. He's just asking. So there is dukkha. 1, 2, 3. True or not true? You know, just thinking about it. Thinking about people you know. Is there anybody exempt from dukkha? You know, it's a kind of intellectual exercise that we Westerners in our culture tend to like to, you know, we want to figure it all out. Thank you. And so the second of the insights. So that's an intellectual insight where you go, oh yeah, that seems true enough intellectually. The second insight is that the instruction is to feel the ouch of the dukkha. Those are my words. It's said dukkha is to be known by penetrating dukkha. So you penetrate it, you feel the ouch of it. And that's much more immediate, and that is the practice element. So first was you could think about it. The second is where you actually practice. You're noticing the dukkha in your life, and you notice what it feels like. And you notice its inevitableness and so forth. You notice its characteristics, like we were noticing the characteristics of the earth element and noticing the characteristics of the wind element. You notice the characteristics of dukkha. And then the third insight is that dukkha has been known, is the way it's said in the text. And by that, it is that we know the truth of dukkha, and we start to incorporate it in how we perceive. So we perceive the world that involves dukkha. It's not that everything in life is dukkha. That is not the teaching. But that it is entwined in everything, because everything's changing and all this, that it's not, we can't separate. It's not like we're going to get away from dukkha. That's the point. So what is a wise relationship with dukkha? And that's the other noble truths have to do with that wise relationship. But this morning we're staying just with this first noble truth, this first ennobling truth. And why is it that dukkha is a noble truth or is ennobling? Because if we learn to stand under dukkha, we gain so much more choice in life. Because the pattern is to try to avoid dukkha. Our usual schematic is avoid the unpleasant and maximize the pleasant. And from the Buddha's teaching, we're not trying to do that. Rather, we're living from our deepest value, what we really care about. And the amount of dukkha we get is the amount of dukkha we get. It's not that we're going and looking for it, but we're not living our life trying to somehow win the game against dukkha. That life's not really about that. It just appears on the surface like that. So we'll see why this is, but there's two kinds of suffering. It's said the suffering that is inevitable, and then the suffering that this wonderful woman who's been dead quite a number of years now, named Helen Luke, she calls neurotic suffering. And she makes the distinction between necessary suffering. You know, we're all going to get sick. We're all going to lose people and so forth. Necessary suffering versus this kind of neurotic suffering. And the neurotic suffering comes because of our unwillingness to bear the world the way it is. Because we have not equipped ourselves, we've not been trained to bear the world the way it is. And which is, leads me on into the second suffering. So I don't want to, the second noble truth, I don't want to go there too much right now. Ajahn Sumedho refers to it as like being willing to stand under a waterfall. You know, the waterfall is just there, but we're willing to stand under it, and we're not. It's not that we're always wanting to stand under it, but we're willing to stand under it if we happen to be at the point in the flow of life where there's a waterfall and it's coming. And Helen Luke refers to it as like being like a wagon carrying a load. It just carries its load, because its nature is that there's a load and it's to be carried. So it's not about us in a personal way. It's impersonal, the impersonal dukkha versus the personal dukkha of our reactive mind in that way. And where our freedom comes, it is in our relationship to dukkha, not getting rid of all dukkha, but getting rid of that, how we're relating to the dukkha, ceasing to have that neurotic dukkha, and being willing to bear with ease and grace the necessary dukkha of this realm. And that's how we grow to have choice, how we have well-being. And it's very practical, very much a blueprint way, as you'll see more of this afternoon. For now, thinking about this dukkha of the realm that's just natural in this, what do we do? What do we do? And there's so many things that are heartbreaking, so many things, and we're unskillful enough ourselves, and then we see other people seemingly much more unskillful than us. Whether or not that's true or not, who knows, because maybe it's just the scale. You know, if we were on their scale, we would be, in our own way, equally unskillful. Who knows? But we're all unskillful enough. So where is the refuge? Where is the refuge in the fact of this suffering? Where's the refuge? Where do we take comfort? And we take comfort and traditionally in the refuge of the Buddha and the Dhamma and Sangha in this tradition. I deliberately didn't start out this way this retreat, but we take refuge in the Buddha, meaning the historical Buddha, meaning the fact that there was a regular human being who could find a relationship with dukkha that was liberating. So the mind was not defined, was not contained, not constrained by the existence of dukkha. And he had dukkha, including his cousin tried to assassinate him. He'd go to these villages. He's walking around barefoot all over northern India, and these villagers would not like him. And Ananda would say to him, "They don't like us here. Let's go somewhere else." And he'd say, "Oh no, we got to stay till they understand us and what we're teaching." And he died of food poisoning, and had a prolonged death. And he also had a bad back. He took a bad fall one time, and he was lying there and for some period of time before he could get up. All this is in the suttas. So it's not that he was in any way immune from the dukkha of this realm, but he was not disturbed by the dukkha of the realm. And it is my own life experience, and certainly the life experience of many others, that in fact we can become more and more that way, where we're less and less defined by the dukkha. It can characterize us, but not define us. Does that make sense? So if we are pleasant-oriented, then we're like, there's pleasant and unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant. This is called Vedana. This is the second foundation of mindfulness, like the body, which we did all morning, was the first foundation. Vedana, this arising of noticing, being mindful of pleasant and unpleasant, like we were mindful of the body breath, we were mindful of this pleasant and unpleasant arising. And we see that that because of things we'll learn in the second noble truth, that we are so prone, we cling to wanting the pleasant. So we're like puppets on a string. If it's pleasant, we want it, we want to hold on to it, we want to justify why we have it and others don't. You know, we're very defensive about that. And we want more. And that wanting more is one of the more unattractive aspects, I have to say, of our minds. But it's the truth. And so if we're going to start with the truth, then that's the part to be done. It's a natural relationship to stimulate. Like when you give a child sugar, they suddenly want sugar because it's so stimulating. We're sort of like a stimulation to pleasant is like sugar to us, and we like want more and more and all this. And it's a kind of drug of how pleasant is, of worldly pleasantness. There's unworldly pleasant, and it's usually not emphasized that much. But the Buddha teaches in that sutta that there's a worldly and unworldly pleasant. So that in worldly pleasant, we like the puppet on the string. If we've got it, we want more of it. If it's unpleasant, we want to avoid it. If we've got it, we want to get rid of it immediately, or we want to blame ourselves or blame someone else for why it's there. There's got to be some reason it's there, and we go into feeling sorry for ourselves and so forth, or resentful or whatever it can be, or feel defeated or learned helplessness and so forth arises, all because of the way we're relating to this. And so that becomes our life, the dance between the pleasant and the unpleasant. And that is, therefore, a dance of life, but it's really around the dukkha, really, because we're trying to avoid the dukkha and have non-dukkha. in a worldly way. And the Buddha said there must be a better way to live than that. And at first he tried learning absorption meditation, deep samadhi meditation, which we call jhana in the Theravada tradition, where the mind's totally protected from any feeling of dukkha in all of these ways. And he found that, in fact, that gave temporary shelter. But when he came out, he was the same old person. So that didn't go anywhere, because that was not really changing. That was just isolating yourself from this realm, not really being in the realm with freedom. And then he tried being a complete ascetic thinking, well, I'll just conquer my identification with this realm as a body and a person of wanting pleasant and all. That didn't work either. And so finally he tried what we were doing. He sat under the tree and he remembered a time in his life when things were pleasant and all, and he did a kind of relaxation approach to meditation like we were doing, and he fell into this insight, to seeing the insights that led to all of this. So where do we take refuge in tough things is that in our own Buddha nature. Like the Buddha, we can bear. We are capable of bearing. We can bear it both physically, mentally, and in our hearts. The truth of dukkha. There's some level where we will all collapse. So thinking that we're invulnerable to collapse, I think is sort of silly. But some people think that way. But in general, we can. It takes more and more to smash us. Yeah, but and we can notice this starting sort of right away in practice. It's not something we have to wait for years for seeing really huge shifts in the amount of equanimity we have can take quite a while. But we have small changes that we can notice right away. So that we take refuge in, the Buddha was a person, I'm a person. So just as the Buddha could do this, I can do this. So we're taking refuge in that capability of knowing, and knowing what? Knowing Dhamma, knowing truth the way it is, Dharma in the Sanskrit, that we know the truth of the way things are, that we're capable of knowing and responding wisely to how things are. And so that's refuge to us. So this is, I can take what seems like meaningless suffering, and by my attitude and my using it as a chance to practice, it becomes meaningful. It is not meaningless suffering anymore. I have found this to be so true for me. So true. Like in the last 3 years, I've had a lot of suffering, and some of it, most of it has been due to kind of medical mistakes. And yet even that, rather than going to anger and all of that, to really staying with the experience and having it be quite meaningful, this experience that was on the whole quite unpleasant and one piece of it horrible, but that the truth of this. And I will make these references to myself just because if no one ever makes any references to themselves about all this, then who is it that's getting this benefit? Who are those people that we can hear all these teachers all around talking about this benefit? Who are those people? How come no one ever proclaims it, you know? And so I've reached that age where I feel comfortable doing that. And then the third refuge, that traditional refuge, is in Sangha, that we can find like-minded people who are wanting to have a different relationship to the truth of dukkha, and in a way that helps us grow and helps us maintain our faith that it's possible. Because if we're by ourselves and everybody's saying, no, you're crazy, that doesn't work, a much better strategy is to get all the toys, you know. And, you know, that he who has the most toys when he dies wins, I guess. Like the joke that was a Southern joke when I was growing up. These guys were watching this funeral procession because the guy was this rich man and he was being buried in his Cadillac. And one guy says to the other guy, "Man, that's really living." So on a more personal level, if we take our life as that the struggles in our life, we want to grow from them in wisdom, but we also want to grow from them in our ability to not so identify with them, to not cling, to not take them so personally. All of this is already there in the First Noble Truth. And any degree of doing this is ennobling. And if you do it quite a number of degrees, that's quite ennobling. If you really do it, that is ennobling. You are a noble one. That is, your heart can stand bearing straight on the truth of suffering. That is an ennobling thing. And you're a much better caretaker for others, much better caretaker for yourself, everything. You're much less likely to cause harm if you can stand dukkha without creating more dukkha for yourself or in others. So it's ennobling. It's ennobling right now. And because I've been doing this teaching in this form for over 20 years, I was teaching a whole other form before then, but I have seen this transformation in a number of people. They have learned to be ennobled by the First Noble Truth. They have a new relationship with dukkha. And I've also met a number of people in life who've never heard of the Four Noble Truths, but who found this on their own. They're so inspiring in the way they have stood under their own suffering that they had to carry. Questions of fairness about suffering. Is the world fair? No. Can we make it more fair? Yes, I believe that. Can we make it absolutely fair? On what basis? I always wanted to be a really good musician, and I never had the chops. And other people have the chops automatically. I worked hard and failed, and these other people didn't have to work hard, and they were really good. That's not fair. It means it's not allocated by way we think it should be allocated. But that's a view as to what we think is the allocation. When people don't have equal chance, and some sort of because of skin color or because of ethnicity or something like this, that's a social issue that we can't address. But we can't address that some people have better gene structure than others, that people have some people have accidents and others don't. We can't address all of that. So our relationship to dukkha is not subject to, it's not a social justice issue in that way. The social justice issue, which is there and is to be addressed, but it's different than the Buddha's. The Buddha's pointing to the nature of the realm here. The fact that he taught to everybody, he was breaking the class norms of his realm. So he was in his own way doing social justice, but that wasn't his. He's pointing to like how we as an individual free our mind, heart to then do whatever is right in terms of social justice, in terms of being a parent, in terms of being a good partner in a relationship, but he's not out there in that realm. He's withdrawn from that realm for the purposes of this purification. And then when he's teaching, he's you know, knowing that the people are living lives. You know, that people are not ascetics, that the kind of ascetic that he is. And he talks about regular happiness, and he names working with Sukha in one of those last chapters of Dance with Life, I name one of his list of all the things that are ordinary sources of happiness, which he includes, by the way, being debt free, which is ironic that 2,600 years ago There was still debt. In this first noble truth, we're changing our attitude from an identification with to a kind of a wise relationship. What is the wisest relationship that's possible for me right now around dukkha? My dukkha and witnessing your dukkha when I care about you. Because it can be very hard to bear the truth of other people's dukkha also. And so we're learning how to have a wise relationship. And then in the second noble truth, we learn how to greatly diminish the dukkha. But because of that optional dukkha that comes along about how we're relating to it. But no matter what, the first noble truth is the first noble truth. And if we can't stand to be with the dukkha, we can't do the second noble truth. We can't get that level of ennobling because we can't get in. We can't stand it. We can't be around it. We can't bear it. We can't carry it. And when I first started teaching, I was surprised that so many people felt like they knew dukkha. And they would kind of move on to the second noble truth, or even the third and fourth. And I'm back here thinking, you know, I really want to know dukkha, and I've been practicing by that point. I've been 20 years, 15, 17 years, whatever it would be, in this tradition. I'd already had all those years of practice and long retreats and all that. And I still was back here at the dukkha thing, like really, so exactly what is this? How does this actually fit in? And I tell you this because there's a lot of freedom right here. Right here. How do I bear the truth of this realm? How do I bear it? What is my attitude? And when it hits me or hits others, and you know, and I've had people come up and say, you know, I don't really feel like I can relate to the first noble truth because I just don't have that much dukkha. And I'd go, well, maybe not, you know, because I don't know you, so I don't know for sure. But like, do you have insecurity? Do you have disappointment? You know, I mean, and I'll question because. The form that dukkha is taking in any given moment in our lives is just the form it's taking in that moment. So we with these three insights, we are now in the territory. We understand this concept about that there's a description of the realm. There is dukkha. That it's not everything's dukkha, but this realm of existence, this manifest realm in a human body. With awareness, with this capability of reflection, so not only do we have experience like other animals, we know we're having those experiences, and we can reflect on those experiences. It's a great gift, but that's a lot to ask for a nervous system, for any kind of an organizing executive function we call ego. This ability that we've slowly developed to have a kind of self-referencing. Capacity that can manage us, you know, get us dressed in the morning and get us to stop at stoplights and recognize who's a good person to be friends with and who's not sometimes. And so it's a lot to ask. It's a lot to ask this. And so, but we do. And that there's this intellectual understanding of it where you go, yes, I think this is true based on my experience, not because the Buddha said it, but based on my experience, there is dukkha. And yes, I know the ouch of dukkha. I can feel the ouch of dukkha. I know what it feels like, all these myriad of forms it takes. And I can observe in others, and I can have empathy and sympathy for the dukkha of others. So I do know dukkha. Internally and externally, and I know that I know. I've looked at this enough. I've really spent time. I've really been sincere So I now feel at this point, although hopefully I will understand dukkha even more in the future, but dukkha has been known. So that is the Buddha knowing the Dhamma. Your Buddha nature knowing the way things are. It's a natural process of this ability of cognizing for that to happen. It's not, there's no magic in it anywhere. There's a lot that's mysterious that in life, and in meditation we run across a lot of that that's mysterious about it, including capabilities that are mysterious. But in my view, none of it is magical in that way. Magic is what belongs in the theater where you know, the acting makes something come alive so we can learn it and feel it as without having to go through it ourselves, you know, but we get that experience. That's a kind of magic, because that's the ability, that's a kind of ability to create. But I don't believe in I don't believe that this world is ruled by magic. I believe it's ruled by mystery, and mystery is lawful. We just don't know the lawfulness of it yet. We don't know what those laws are. We know the laws of a lot of things, and they proved to be reasonably reliable. And we'll hopefully know more, and we can in this area know more about our own internal experience of the mystery. We gain certain access, certain abilities around that. So I'm going to stop here in a minute, but before I do, any questions about the First Noble Truth, about the First Noble Truth in your life, about any of the insights? So she asked about bearing wisely the dukkha of others. Yes, so, and again, I describe all this in more detail, so you can look at it in the Dance with Life book. But the first thing is that for some people, and I was one of those, the dukkha of others was much worse for me than my own dukkha from childhood on. I was somehow a tough-minded kid, so I could stand my dukkha, but I couldn't stand the dukkha of my brothers and sisters. It would just tear me up. So my experiences in some ways were more harsh, but it was much easier for me to experience those than to witness their experience. It was So that was my first experience with all that. Then at some point I realized, oh, the world has all of this, you know, all this terrible stuff in it. And I made this common mistake that can be made where you imagine, so you don't know you're doing this, but you imagine that there's one person experiencing all that dukkha. But there is no one person experiencing all that dukkha. There's millions and now billions of us experiencing that dukkha. So if we take it as though it's one solid thing, it will demolish us. We get defeated. We're just like, life's meaningless. You know, I mean, literally, just like, because we've taken it all in so incorrectly, because it's all spread out. And likewise, by the way, in us, there's all of the dukkha we've known is not there in any given moment. And because of anicca, we know it comes and goes. But again, we can perceive that about ourselves. And again, because of the, you know, functioning in the mind around depression and all, give up on ourselves, give up on life. Very understandable why that happens. And So that's another way about opening. A third way of opening to the dukkha of others is compassion is what the Buddha calls the heart's quiver, and that compassion is a kind of a caring for them, but not an identification where you add to the suffering of the world. So when you open to the fact that others are having suffering, if you then start suffering because of that, then you've added to the suffering of the world rather than lessened it. And likewise, if you fall off on the other side, you're pitying. You're not offering compassion, you're offering pity. And there's I've had the privilege to work, but it's been a difficult circumstance where people have a child that's has a difficult life, or is in the process of dying, or has died, and they're living with this big handicap that really, from our point of view of having wider in this way, the mother or the father is seeing the child's life so circumscribed that they feel like they're just kind of collapsed around that. And I say over and over again, you're denying this child's life. The child's life is like this. They don't have some other life. If you're not celebrating them in this life, then you're not celebrating them. They don't have some other life. You're wanting them to have another life is great that you want them to have another life, but not if you're rejecting them. You're implicitly rejecting them because you're not really celebrating them as they are. This is the only life they have. So celebrate them as they are with this characteristic or that characteristic, whatever it is. There's not any other child that's here right now. And it's you're turning the vibes off here, you know. And that's gone mixed. That's gone mixed. But so many people, either then or later, come back to me and say, thank you, thank you. That's really true. It's really true. And so that's another example of how to open to someone else's suffering. And then this appropriate response idea, which is that a phrase comes out of Zen, but the appropriate response to dukkha, if it's dukkha that I can help relieve in another, then that's an appropriate response. If I can't relieve it, I can acknowledge them for having to carry it. If it's a social injustice kind of thing, I can acknowledge the wrongness, even if I can't change it at this time or be part of the many millions of people changing it, whatever that is. So we have an appropriate response to it. So that's some things. Another question before we go to lunch?
This is just an instance of the truths that you've discovered. Melinda Gates is the wife of Bill Gates, who lives in this area. Mm-hmm. She's a personal heroine of mine because I heard her say one time, you have to be willing to have your heart broken in order to hear what other people need. And I think what she was saying was, I have had to learn to stand under the suffering of almost the whole world in order to do whatever I can. And one example she gave was that often people offer her their children. They want her to take their child so that their child will have a chance in life. How can she do that? So she has said, I have to stand there and weep. And then I have to say, no, I can't take the child. But I think she is one example of a human being who has had to stand under tremendous dukkha, find a response, knowing she cannot heal everything.
I don't know her, but I can support that. That she's had to do that in that way. She's also had the incredible blessing of having resources to actually be able to respond. The thing about you and I and others in the room, we have, when we open, we have so much less way to respond. And so you, in that sense, this is the Buddha not comparing and judging. So your relation to dukkha is no less than hers, nor no more, nor the same as. So, and I'm using this as an opportunity to teach. I'm not picking on you in any way, but it's such a beautiful example of that. Because we do tend to look at this in terms of comparison, because certainly we want examples, for sure, in all this. But I'm wanting to really make this point to each of you, that you're having your experience, you're wanting to learn, so you use what looks like judging and comparing as mental activities, but you're doing it for discerning, not for the labeling of better than, worse than, more than, less than, any of that, but to have your own experience of the truth of you in this life, here and now. Here and now. This and there's a way we come to find our dignity that as not sort of in the self-help books, but it's here in the Dhamma in some way that it's not easy to capture, but every experience, every thought even, is worthy of mindfulness. And that's kind of strange because some of the thoughts are not wholesome thoughts, but they're still worthy of mindfulness. And they're worthy of mindfulness because every thought can be learned from, every thought that when we see clearly, we have a wise relationship with it. And so our dignity is that is coming from our commitment to clarity and from living out choice as far as we have choice. Sometimes we don't, we don't recognize choice, or sometimes we have the choice, but we just don't have the conditions where we can choose, even though we know we should choose and we know we could, but the conditions aren't right. Our psychological, emotional conditions aren't right. So we have to witness the failing that we had choice, but we couldn't make it. And people can get really down on that, but the willing to stand under that is dignity. I failed in that way. And rather than hating yourself and guilt and shame, no, I failed. And from that failure, I want to be more empowered to the next opportunity that I will do otherwise. That's the dignity of it. That's that we're treating ourselves in our capability rather than our shortcomings. Do you see? Because being organized around our shortcomings diminishes us, but it also lets us off the hook in a certain way. If you just feel guilty and shame, that doesn't mean that you have to do better next time. But if you treat this very same situation, no, I failed, but I am capable, and I know I'm capable, and I'm not going to BS myself about this. I am capable, just as I am, of doing better. And I resolve, I take this, and the next time I will do other. That's forward leading in the way of the Dhamma. I said I was going to be on the subtle aspects on this. I hope I'm not being too subtle here, but I came up here with this is the kind of thing I've come here to impart these days, is these understandings that are sort of not the typical understandings that are given in Dharma talks this is the truth of life. It's this is the way it is. And when Sumedho's saying we are awareness, you are that awareness, and it's impersonal. There's only one awareness, and we all have that awareness. We're all that awareness. That's the unity, and that's Vedanta and all of that kind of thing too. But the other side of it, so that's unity. But in my own mantra work, I my aspiration that I state is towards wholeness as well as unity. Wholeness is 24/7, showing up in all aspects of our lives. And so sometimes we can have our spiritual work segmented or our psychological work segmented over here, but we're not committed to 24/7 in all aspects of our life. And I from very early on knew that I wanted to show up as practice in all parts of my life. I don't know why that's what I wanted, because I actually had, some natural gifts in terms of, that wholeness, that kind of meditative experience and all that. But I, for whatever reason, this is what I wanted all along, and it took me a long time to find that the right teachings for this and all. And I have now seen how it bears fruit, So I'm wanting to share this in this way, that we are to use that phrase, defining deviancy down, that I can't think of the, I'm at the age where I lose names. But we shortchange ourselves. And we shortchange ourselves individually, but then the Sangha as a whole is shortchanged because we're all shortchanging. So rather than inspiring each other, we're kind of letting each other off the hook, and what do we get for it? I mean, what do we get for it? There's some discomfort that we get to avoid, but I don't see much other than that. And we need to distract ourselves more because of that, of course. And so we spend time distracting ourselves, but we can turn towards what we know, what's capable of our hearts, and that is, to me, what the Four Noble Truths really are empowering us to do. Time for lunch.